is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Sadly, if not unpredictably, the impact of COVID-19 on women, adolescents and children has been disproportionate and it has been profound. We also know that no country has been spared.
That's Wendy Morton, a minister at the UK Foreign Office, on how women and girls continue to face intensified risks exacerbated by the impact of COVID-19. Details coming up. Also, a volcano erupts in eastern DRC, killing at least 15 people. And U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says it is time the international community to take action to end the deadly fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Ending the COVID-19 pandemic and preventing future pandemics is expected to dominate discussions during this week's 74th World Health Assembly, the decision-making body of the World Health Organization. The session will also address other pressing global health issues. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The 2021 World Health Assembly will be held virtually from May 24th through June 1st. This, in and of itself, is aimed at sending a strong message that it still is not safe for large groups of people to gather physically. More than 2,750 people so far have registered to attend the virtual event. WHO declared the COVID-19 outbreak a pandemic and a global international public health emergency on March 11th, 2020. Since then, COVID-19 cases have increased 40-fold to 162 million, including more than 3.3 million deaths. Discussions on a so-called pandemic treaty to better prepare for and prevent global infectious outbreaks is expected to take center stage at the Global Assembly. WHO Chief Legal Officer Stephen Solomon says drafting a treaty would be a long process. He says delegates have not decided whether negotiations on a treaty should be started. He says a legally binding pandemic convention would cover both substantive issues, which include equitable sharing of materials such as vaccines and diagnoses, and structural ones.
Structurally, you know, the elements that often comes up is issues of enforcement mechanisms, compliance mechanisms, monitoring mechanisms, incentives and disincentives. There's clearly issues of governance and how that would work under treaty institutions and financing.
The assembly will face the largest agenda ever over the coming 8 days, with more than 72 global health issues under examination. Questions of vaccine equity will be central to these discussions. Wealthy countries are making great strides in vaccinating their populations and returning to a semblance of normal life, but poor countries are not. WHO warns vaccine inequity threatens ending the pandemic and global recovery from the pandemic. As in previous years, the issue of granting Taiwan observer status at the WHA will come up for debate at the opening session. China claims Taiwan is one of its provinces and has blocked Taiwan's participation since 2016. Under Beijing's One China policy, the Chinese Communist Party asserts sovereignty over Taiwan. This year, 13 WHO member states, including the United States, have called for Taiwan to be allowed to take part in proceedings. They say Taiwan has great insight on tackling the pandemic and would have a lot to contribute. Other significant issues to be addressed include the eradication of polio, speeding action on antimicrobial resistance, and considering WHO's global strategy on health, environment, and climate change. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Mount Nyiragongo erupted Saturday night near the city of Goma in eastern DRC, sending torrents of lava into villages with little warning. At least 15 people were killed and more than 500 homes were destroyed. UNICEF officials say more than 170 children are still feared missing. Reuters reporter Soraya Ali was at the scene and described the devastation.
A volcanic eruption appeared to have halted on Sunday morning after raging through local villages. Video footage showed a smoking trail of lava pouring down on Saturday night as the nearby Mount Nyiragongo erupted. Thousands fled with their belongings on foot, some towards the nearby border with Rwanda. This man from a local village says he woke up and saw the red sky and lava. He, along with other residents, fled and are looking for shelter in Goma. As the sun rose on Sunday, much of the hillside to the north of the town was burned black and houses had been demolished. The sky was once again a cloudy grey. Lava crossed a main road out of Goma, cutting it off from cities to the north. Traffic was in gridlock in most places as people tried to leave or return to assess the damage to their homes. This local resident said the government must figure out how to reopen this road so that residents can travel between Goma and Rwanda. Saturday's eruption appears to have been caused when fractures opened in the volcano's side, causing lava flows in various directions. Nyiragongo's previous eruption in 2002 killed 250 people and left 120,000 homeless. It's one of the world's most active volcanoes and is considered among the most dangerous.
That was Reuters reporter Soraya Ali at the scene of a volcanic eruption outside Goma in the DRC. As COVID-19 rages around the world, women and girls continue to face intensified risks exacerbated by the pandemic. Now campaigners say focused action is urgently needed in a growing number of low- and middle-income countries. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
At a recent virtual global summit, more than 1,000 participants from around the world highlighted the need for targeted investments in pro-equity programs to combat the devastating social and economic effects of COVID-19. Speaking at the two-day event, leaders from several African countries, including Nigeria, Senegal, South Africa, Kenya, and Malawi, gave details about the devastation of the pandemic on the health of women, children, and adolescents. Awa Marie Kolsek is Minister of State to the President of Senegal.
Data collection on issues facing women and girls are irregular, but also the knowledge gap exists for new and emerging issues. Several countries like Rwanda or Senegal have made progress in this direction. Government and their partners need to make sure that the more vulnerable are effectively reached.
Globally, 350,000 women die each year in pregnancy or childbirth, according to the World Health Organization. The United Nations Population Fund says that in 2020, 12 million women experienced disruptions in family planning services due to the pandemic, with more than 1 million unintended pregnancies across 115 low- and middle-income countries. South Africa's Health Minister, Zweli Lawrence Mkhize, said that COVID-19 has devastated economies and affected social and community life, adding that women, children and adolescents have been significantly affected. The He Summit, dubbed Lives in the Balance, was organized by several partners, including the Vaccine Alliance, known as Gavi, and the Partnership for Maternal, Newborn and Child Health. It's a coalition of more than 1,000 organizations committed to protecting and advocating for the health, well-being and the rights of women, children and adolescents. Helen Clark is the board chair of the partnership and former Prime Minister of New Zealand.
To date, only 2% of the total number of vaccinations actually administered have been administered in Africa. And this geographic inequity puts at particular risk populations in the world's low and middle income countries where the greatest number of maternal child and adolescent deaths occur. This very simple truth is this: none of us will be safe from COVID until we are all safe.
She called on the global community to diversify the production and distribution of vaccines, calling it urgent, so that communities around the world can have access to more vaccines. Last year, the partnership issued a 7-point call to action in response to the devastating effects of COVID-19 on the health and well-being of women, children, and adolescents. Some say the pandemic has brought about massive shocks to already struggling health systems globally. Kenya, Nigeria, and Liberia are among the countries that have made commitments to protect this vulnerable group. Dr. Mercy Onsando is Chief Executive Officer of Health NGOs Network in Kenya.
Kenya, as we always front runners, we were not left behind, but we signed this commitment to improve and increase investment in the health system and social protection policies for women, children and adolescents as the world rebuilds from the impact of COVID-19 pandemic. We are very grateful that the government of Kenya did sign to these commitments. And not only did the government sign, but also committed funding.
The participants, including representatives from the civil society, the UN, academia, the private and public sectors, discussed solutions to mitigate the impacts of the pandemic. Wendy Moulton, a minister at the UK's Foreign Office, gave more details.
Sadly, if not unpredictably, the impact of COVID-19 on women, adolescents and children has been disproportionate and it has been profound. We also know that no country has been spared, so the only rational way forward is a way we find together. As global leaders, we have to advocate in the strongest possible terms for gender equality and for the needs of women and children to be at the heart of our efforts to rebuild.
Experts say the pandemic has disrupted the provision of life-saving services in the healthcare system, contributing to the erosion of sexual and reproductive health and rights of women and adolescents, and further exposing and exacerbating ethnic and gender inequalities everywhere. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says it is time for the international community to take action to end the deadly fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region. The Associated Press reports the U.S. is restricting visas for people, undermining efforts to resolve the unrest and imposing wide-ranging restrictions on economic and security assistance to Ethiopia. Local authorities and aid groups say thousands of people are estimated to have died since the conflict erupted 6 months ago. Ethiopia's government issued a statement today criticizing the U.S. actions, calling them ill-advised and saying they send a wrong signal as the country prepares for national elections. It added that it is completely unacceptable for the U.S. to meddle in Ethiopia's internal affairs. Atrocities, including rape, extrajudicial killings, and forced evictions, have been part of the violence. Blinken said yesterday that despite significant diplomatic engagement, the parties of the conflict in Tigray have taken no meaningful steps to end hostilities or pursue a peaceful resolution of the political crisis. Without an immediate cessation of hostilities and a rapid expansion of humanitarian access, Blinken said, food insecurity could lead to massive hunger. Egypt reasserted itself as a key Middle East mediator after it successfully brokered a ceasefire deal in the short but costly Israel-Hamas war in the Gaza Strip. Some analysts believe Egypt's role could help improve the strained ties between President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi and his U.S. counterpart, Joe Biden. They spoke last Thursday for the first time since Biden's election. Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, spoke about the situation with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Democrats are more idealistic in foreign relations, and they ignored real politics. And that's why there was no phone call since Biden came to power. And in fact, even before coming to power, he had very negative views of Trump's favorite dictator. The Gaza crisis was a wake-up call to the real world and the regional geopolitical importance of Egypt in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Israel also wanted a way out of a deteriorating, embarrassing political and military situation. We see now growing warming up in relations between the two governments, the Sisi and the White House. But the real test is what the U.S. would do to help resolve the Ethiopian Gerd crisis, which Egypt is expecting and had been officially calling on Washington to be more active in that crisis.
Egypt reassessed itself as an indispensable mediator in the Middle East after it successfully brokered a ceasefire deal in the short war between Hamas and Israel in Gaza. How would that enhance Egypt's regional relevance and influence to all parties concerned, including the United States?
As you know, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict still remains very popular among the peoples of the Arab and Islamic world, and even people who have a strong belief in human rights. Regimes in the Middle East used to compete to win popularity by showing that they stand up for and defend the Palestinians. This includes many regimes, Qatar, Turkey, Iran. But Egypt has a better edge because it is geopolitically close to Gaza. So the Egyptian ceasefire mediation and reconstruction fund that was allocated enhanced Egypt's position in the Arab Islamic world. It would also help polish the image of the Egyptian leadership in many Arab and Muslim circles and boost EU American support of the regime as an essential, indispensable regional player. Cairo would help mobilize this diplomatic and popular support to help in resolving the growing crisis with Ethiopia.
President El-Sisi has also promised $500 million in aid for Gaza to rebuild, as well as eased its blockade to send ambulances and supplies. How popular was that move among the Egyptian public?
No one opposed giving Egyptian medical assistance to Gaza, but more people oppose giving money to Gazans and Hamas at a difficult domestic economic situation. And for those whom Egyptian media and popular soap operas have accused of backing some terrorist Islamic organization in North Sinai and the killing of the Egyptian military. Interest and support of the Palestinian question has been declining over the decades in Egypt. In fact, only two leftist journalists tried to demonstrate in support of the Palestinians in Tahrir Square. In the end, the Egyptians left the matter to the assessment of the national interest by the state.
That was Saeed Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. Today, the International Criminal Court prosecutor opened a hearing against an alleged leader of the Janjaweed militia blamed for atrocities in Sudan's Darfur region. Ali Muhammad Ali Abdul Rahman Ali, known as Ali Kushaib, is charged with 31 counts of crimes against humanity and war crimes, including murder, rape, torture, and persecution. He has not entered a plea, but last year he told judges the allegations were untrue. This was the first evidence presented against a suspect charged with involvement in crimes by the Janjaweed militia in Darfur. Elise Kepler is Associate Director of the International Justice Program at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She told VOA's James Butty that the purpose of today's hearing is for judges to assess if there is enough evidence for the case to go to trial. A decision is expected later this year. The Darfur conflict began in 2003 when rebels from the territory's ethnic Central and Sub-Saharan African community launched an insurgency against the Arab-dominated government in Khartoum. The government of now-deposed President Omar al-Bashir responded with bombings and unleashed Janjaweed militias who are accused of mass killings and rapes. Up to 300,000 people were killed. Al-Bashir has been charged with crimes, including genocide, for masterminding the operation and is jailed in Khartoum. South Africa's rand is strengthening remarkably against the U.S. dollar. Just a few months ago, $1 was valued at almost 17 rand. Now it's less than 14. Financial analysts say the rand's resurgence has been sparked partly by renewed foreign investor interest in emerging markets such as South Africa's. But in the face of this unexpected optimism, citizens continue to struggle to make ends meet, with unemployment and poverty rising. Here's Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Data from financial services company Transaction Capital reveals that 34% of South African households are expected to drop out of the middle class this year. Economists say the COVID-19 pandemic and a weak economy, caused in part by lack of government policy reforms, are the primary reasons. Two international ratings agencies released their reviews of South Africa this weekend. Independent economic analyst Rapiwe Matsena says they had several concerns.
One of the biggest things is the way that South Africa is going to be able to handle debt and also be able to manage the wage bill. There's a lot of tension between government and the unions when it comes to increases on a government worker wages. So those were the things that they're...
She says the agency is also concerned about tensions that seem to be splitting the ruling African National Congress, or ANC. Yet the rand continues to strengthen. On paper, says Matsena, this should be good for the nation.
The cost of buying things is likely to be lower because bringing things into the country is going to be a little bit more cheaper. And things that I'm talking about here that we are net importers of are things like oil, which contributes to the oil price, and other foodstuffs. So you might see a drop in the price of petrol, for example, or other foodstuffs that you may buy.
Matsena, however, agrees with plenty of other financial experts that these positive developments won't be nearly enough to pull South Africa out of its economic plight. A big factor contributing to this crisis, according to energy expert Ted Blom, is the unreliable electricity supply that results in frequent blackouts. South Africa's national power company, Eskom, recently increased its tariffs by almost 16%. Blom calls it a desperate effort to recover some of the 800 billion rands a commission of inquiry says was looted by corrupt managers over the past decade or so.
The tariffs have gone up by more than 500% over the last 12 years. The price of electricity is not allowed to go up by more than CPI. And that means that you and I should not be paying more than 50 to 60 cents a kilowatt hour versus the over 2 rand that we're actually paying at the moment. It's really a disease that has killed South Africa's economy and is busy killing its citizens because we cannot afford the price of electricity.
University of KwaZulu-Natal economics professor Bonke Dumisa says some of citizens' economic wounds are self-inflicted because they're living above their means.
We have got to start distinguishing between what we really need as a family and as individuals, which we can afford without resorting to credit, and what are the things that we want. Because it is scary when you look at the levels in South Africa. South Africans, at least over 3 million of them, have got more than 2 credit accounts.
But other research shows many citizens are using credit cards to pay for food and other necessities, not for luxuries. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Ihiyes Wuhid in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the